Hello, everyone, and welcome to JFG tonight. How are you doing, people of the regular chat? That is the next level comfort for spiders. If you're a spider, look at what the spider has built. They call it a silk henge. It's a device for reproduction. She builds a whole fence system that keeps it keeps other insects from reaching her eggs. And there are two eggs hidden in the centerpiece. The centerpiece is tied to the fence, keeping it up. That is fascinating. I've never seen that before. A silk henge typically consists of a central spire constructed of spider silk, containing one to two eggs surrounded by a fence of silk in a circle. Silk henges were discovered in 2013 by Georgia Tech student Troy Alexander. He posted a picture on Reddit asking for help identifying it. Wow. Next level comfort for baby making. Real Base Talk says, hi chat. Silver Spider says it was either US or Israel for sure. I'm sure Israel has no indication of US involvement either. Yeah, this loose denial by the US is not even a denial. This whole idea that the attack that has happened in Iran, they don't have indications that it's Israel. Now, that's a very shy way to deny. It means, well, they haven't told us it was them. It makes me think of the whole pipeline between Russia and Germany, the Nord Stream pipeline. They had done the same thing back in the days. Oh, well, we have no direct evidence that it's Ukraine. But yeah, it's one of these countries whose interests are aligned with the US and Israel for sure. Now, whether they use the whether they used proxies within Iran, revolutionaries that they control, that doesn't matter very much to me. It totally goes into line with, well, this whole attack in Iran goes in line with American interest, but not American interest in the sense of the American people, but, you know, the warmongers of America, the neocon American interest. Provoking Iran further, trying to basically start a war with Iran. And I would suggest that if we have seen these explosions within Iran, which are labeled terrorist explosions, but it's the kind of terror I would expect from Israel or the US, that means that the US really wants a war with Iran. They want to cause it. They're probably looking to cause a response that they can then use as an excuse for escalation. Speaker's Corner says, Bitcoin dip for ants and everyone freaking out. Yeah, Bitcoin has dipped at 42,000 this morning. Now, well, even flirted with 40K. And now it's back to 42,800. I have the block clock right in front of me here on my desk. I enjoy this. I don't have to keep a tab open anymore for the Bitcoin price. I don't think it's dramatic. They pulled some excuse. They pulled a Matrix, a new organization called Matrix something. We never heard of them. And suddenly one guy in this organization made a report. The report was claiming that Bitcoin ETF will be refused, will be rejected, that the companies have not adhered to the SEC's requests for protecting the Bitcoin ETF from being used for money laundering. And it was per speculation. Could be, could not be, but it was per speculation thrown onto the public space, seemingly for causing a local small crash. So I believe that if we saw the price drop, it's not indicative of a massive market movement. Rather, it is indicative that some people were in long. There were too many people in longs that were leveraged and they needed to be reset. and there were too many exchanges that had an interest in causing a crash. I think it will recover relatively quick, and I don't think that the report is particularly trustable. In fact, the very same organization published another report on the same day saying that Bitcoin was added to 50K because of the ETF enthusiasm. When you do the two predictions at the same time, you can't be wrong. You have to be right. But yeah, so they do this kind of, and this was all published yesterday on January 2nd. The same organization publishing two guidance. One is that Bitcoin will rise, one is that Bitcoin will fall. Well, and now you have the public attention is driven specifically toward the fall report, not toward the up report. That looks like a campaign for causing a miniature small crash. John Drake says, five weeks ago, the same company was saying the ETFs were all but assured agents of FUD. Yeah, I think you can probably pay these companies to say whatever you want. Write me a report that says that the sun won't rise tomorrow. The quadranted meteor shower, I believe I've seen this, because I've seen four meteors. Was it a week or two ago, I think? But now the quadranted meteor shower 2024 peaks tonight alongside a bright moon. At greatest activity, 60 to 120 meteors per hour have been reported during the quadranteds. Early each January, the quadranted meteor stream provides one of the most intense annual meteor displays, with a brief, sharp maximum lasting only a few hours. It will radiate from the northeast corner of the constellation of Bootes, whatever that is. All right. Crumbs of a dead comet. At greatest activity, 60 to 120 meteor per hour. The stream of particles that produce this shower is a narrow one, apparently derived within the last 500 years from a small comet. So it's hanging out there, and every year we cross that part of space, apparently. Isn't that fascinating? It's just a bunch of rock hanging out there, and we keep crossing them again and again. Master Slave says, you really think the Zionist machine is going to let BTC become a competitor to the dollar? I think they're not going to have much of a choice. You may find me naive, and I shouldn't be naive. With everything I've seen in life, I should be like the guy with burnt hair, and I should be totally raped by life, you know? But yeah, I don't think they can do anything against Bitcoin. Never forget, we're talking about a bunch of bits within computers. And, you know, I would tell you the same thing back in 1995. Do you think the Zionist machine is going to let the media be independent on the internet? But it's like they try to censor, they tried a lot of things, but in the end, internet liberty won. And I believe that Bitcoin will win. I believe that Bitcoin will win. Call me naive, I think it's happening. DK Shadow says they are not omnipotent. Yeah, with time, you know, you can eventually realize that they try a lot of stuff that they fail at. And that the Zionists, they are investing a lot of money in unproductive endeavors. They are wasting away their energies. And what they did with me, for example, is one of these things. It's like, okay, you write these hit pieces. You had a public thinker who was willing to debate anyone, who was willing to defend a couple of ideas, and you just don't like his axis or his angle on things, and so you smear him from 2016 with these smear articles about my personal life, up to recently with the murder stuff. And that is a very expensive machine. That is, it's a machine of losses, and it's not as powerful as some people think. Not as powerful. Because I stood to this machine and I said, fuck it, in its face. And they really never hurt me. They never got to me in a way that would threaten even my ability to survive financially. So it's like they're not super powerful. They are really limited in what they can do. So that's why they do these passive aggressive hit pieces and we're not gonna read the book of JF. Okay, it's like you deprive yourself of knowledge. You're not advancing. You know, since my book, which they refuse to read, what's the great advance of biology? We're in 2024. 2024. I wrote my book in 2018. What is the great progress in the field of emergence of life or astrobiology or whatever, in the whole of biology? Nothing is coming up. You're gonna have to read my book, motherfuckers. And so it's like, no matter, I could be in jail for murder, and you should still have to read my book. Speaker's Corner says, Jeff, have you read the book, The Block Size War, regarding Bitcoin? That is important lore. I think it's an interesting story, and I'd love to read the book, but I've not read the book, no. I would love to know more about this. I think it is an important story indeed. It looks interesting. I don't know that I have time, though, to read a whole book about a Bitcoin event. Like, I don't know if I have time to do this in my life. It might never happen because I have too much responsibilities on my shoulder. Talking about the bullish Bitcoin, none of you are bullish enough. If you really want to be a top Bitcoin supporter, you need to believe that the Costco hot dog will one day be one sat. Now that is bullish. That is bullish. And you know, it could happen. Now I don't know what's the math on this. When the Costco hot dog is one sat, let's say I have 5 Bitcoins. How rich am I? I think I'm pretty rich. I think I can eat Costco hot dogs forever. But yeah, it's possible that one day we have the Costco hot dog, which is, in our society, is $1.50 here in Canada. And I believe it was $1 not so long ago. Man, I have actually been fed the Costco hot dog for a part of my life. In the years 2016, if you wonder what's the backstory on JF, why did he become JF? In 2016, 2017, I was working at an EJ. I was working at a grocery store in Quebec, placing milk, thinking about kraut and tea and preparing my videos of the night. I was like, okay, I'm going to do a stream. I'm going to debunk kraut and tea. And I was placing milk as I was thinking about all this. And every day at my break, instead of eating at my own grocery store where I worked, which was overpriced, I was driving to the Costco and paying $1.50. And for $1.50, I didn't even need my Costco membership card because I was entering through the exit. And they were giving me a big hot dog and a Diet Coke drink with whatever I wanted in the hot dog. I ate this for 2 years in a row. I basically ate this every day. $1.50 Canadian, the equivalent of $1.25 US. I was getting my meal. And I was able to save money and start investing in Bitcoin while I was placing milk and working at minimal salary in Canada. That is the Master Slave says, Jeff, stop daydreaming and place the milk faster. I was pretty good at placing milk, let me tell you. I was delivering a good service. And when I left, people started discovering that I was a YouTuber when I left the job. And I remember this boomer I was working with in the milk section. He was like, hey, Jeff, don't take it wrong, but, you know, I know you're going next week. I know you're leaving. I was happy to work with you. But we started talking about, we saw you on YouTube. And that's when I was starting going to Andy Warski. That's where I was starting co-hosting at Andy Warski. And he was like, you never told us this. You have this whole parallel life. And you're always here and you never talk. And you just place milk. But there you are out there commenting on politics. And I was like, yeah, that's just who I am. I'm doing these things and they're going so well right now that I can afford leaving my job. And so that's why I don't need to place milk anymore. And he was like, I support that. I'm super happy for you. So that was my grocery store job, discovering that I was a YouTuber. And that's the last job I ever had in terms of like regular normie employment. I don't think I can ever get normie employment again. Saturn Shine says, the selfish people make out must be evolutionary. Phantom of the Odyssey says, I just had hot dogs. Yeah, Matrix Sport, that is the name of the company that they have a tinker there, and the tinker decided to publish yesterday why the SEC will reject the Bitcoin spot ETFs again. My God. FUD, FUD, FUD. On the very same day, the same Matrix Sport publishes Bitcoin spot ETF approval imminent, BTC to jump $50,000. On the same day, you have an inconsistency of belief here. So we have to talk about the situation in Israel. Israel is becoming very provocative of the surrounding. Lebanon and Iran are two potential targets that seems like Israel is working very hard to provoke these countries. We may convert toward a war of expansion involving the U.S. somehow, perhaps to some extent. Either toward Lebanon or a war of neutralization of military stuff toward Iran. But it seems that when you look at this map, it seems that Israel is very interested in Lebanon. They are bombarding a lot in that direction. And I wouldn't be surprised that it has to do with the speculations of Semiogog around the Mediterranean Sea and the whole oil industry in this part of the world. Because if you can get the border of the sea, you have more access to more oil drilling. And it's not random that Israel went for Gaza now and is bombarding also Lebanon. Jeff Younger was saying, Israel has provoked a regional war. We let them. Germany just told all of its citizens to leave Lebanon immediately. We have also had this order in Canada, so all Canadian, German, and many other citizens who are in Lebanon are being asked to leave the country. Does that mean that Lebanon is getting ready to go martial law or something like this? Or does it mean that they know massive strikes are incoming from the Israeli side? I don't know. It's going to be hard, though. If Israel wants to expand into Lebanon, I would expect support to come to Lebanon. In the same way support has come from to Syria in its alliance kind of with Iranian forces as well as Russian forces. I don't know if they will let they won't let Lebanon be lost easily to the Israeli army. and when you see the problems that they are faced in progressing just into Gaza, imagine facing an organized country that can fight back. I think it's going to be very hard for Israel, but Israel seems very intent on causing these provocations, the biggest provocations recently being this Iranian terrorist attack, the bombing at a cemetery of a celebration of the anniversary of death of Soleiman, this guy who had been killed and bragged. Trump had bragged that he had killed Soleimani, it was Trump's wink to the neocon terrorist, basically showing them, I'm not going to drain the swamp of you guys. I'm still with you guys. I'm still a Zionist. I'm just making bravado to win elections. So basically Trump had betrayed his base by going with the Zionists and basically getting involved in these foreign wars, which massively his base was interested at getting de-involved, at getting uninvolved in this in these Middle Eastern conflict, but Trump showed up back into it. And Trump was describing his attack onto Soleimani as basically it was all prepared by his staff, and they came to him and they said, look, we have a whole plan to kill this guy. Do you want us to kill this guy? It looks very much like something that was put on a silver platter by Zionist and terrorist that Trump decided to say yes to, in the same way all American presidents have kneeled to Zionist and terrorist in the past. So we have here the loose denial from the American side on. There was a celebration of Qasem Soleimani's assassination or death, an anniversary of it. And so you can think that the people who were in the celebration were probably, there was probably a high concentration of people close to the military of Iran, close to all of these forces of Iran that are intervening here and there in the Middle East in many conflicts. And if they were celebrating the anniversary of Soleimani's death, they would be supporters of an anti-Zionist, anti-American agenda. And so two cars were containing bombs, and here they report 103 killed and 141 injured. So there were massive bombs that were meant to kill a lot of people. In fact, some counts on Twitter have been updated to 200 deaths, but I don't know if they are accurate. In any case, a lot of fatalities. And here we can see the aftermath where bodies were being carried. All right. And the U.S. side, all they have to say is that they have no indications. But the U.S. should be able to have intelligence. And the fact that they are not sharing intelligence means we are just willing to talk to you about indications. Basically, we're telling you, well, they didn't tell us it was them. But that is a very low degree of transparency. You should have intel. You might know, in fact, in advance that it was going to happen. And so you should know, you probably know who's involved. And the reason you say no indication is you don't want to do a hard denial. You don't want to say something like, it's not Israel, because you know it's Israel. So I think, as far as I'm concerned, it's basically an admission. I don't see the difference between this and an admission. And at the Justice Report, that news, they say Zionist fingerprints all over the terrorist attack that killed 100 people at Soleimani's tomb. A pair of explosions rocked and was covered as a terrorist attack by Iranian state media. According to Iranian state television, two explosions ripped through an anniversary event at a cemetery in the southeastern city of Kerman, where Soleimani is buried. Commander Soleimani was killed in a state-sanctioned drone attack by then-President Donald Trump, is widely regarded as the architect behind the axis of resistance against Israel, which includes Hamas and other militant organizations currently engaged in a fight to liberate Palestine. And the fact that they chose to hit on a cemetery is kind of symbolic. I think it tells us this is meant as a provocation, because it's not like they bombarded a satellite entity or a military facility. They targeted human beings that were likely to be shocked and to be joining a military response to this attack. So if you wanted to provoke Iran, that there was no better symbolic way to do this. This looks like someone very important, either on the U.S. or Israel side, has decided that we were causing World War III. Yes, DK Shadow, they really want World War III. That is the message I'm getting from this attack. Now, it doesn't mean that Iran will respond in such a way that will force an escalation, but it means we are in it. We are really in the escalation that I described in my predictions of a few days ago. I said we're going to have massive military escalation. Well, there you go. Iran attacked on its soil in a way as to kind of insult the memory of Soleimani, who represents this whole, the fact that America is not the only force in the Middle East determining what everyone does. So Soleimani is a reminder that there are forces in the Middle East that America doesn't control. And if it continues in that trend, what we might see is not so much a military confrontation, army against army. What we may see is a subversion campaign organized under the umbrella of the US and Israel to destroy Iran from the inside. You know, covering this as terrorist actions, it's very possible that the strategy of the American empire will be to foment a revolution within Iran. It wouldn't even be the first time we attempt this. So we'll see what happens with this, but Iran is going to be hard to play on this, because Iran has a history of understanding this is what America does. They develop these small networks, they fund these networks locally, and they make them commit actions against the regime in a way as to destabilize the regime. Vicious says they killed Kennedy, they attacked the USS Liberty, they did 9/11. This escalation is a vicious circular pattern. Absolutely, which is why it's so important that we talk about the Zionist grasp onto American policy. It's because there is a lot of human suffering generated by all of this. And for something that doesn't really concern us. Meanwhile, further escalation in the region, the Houthis claim another container ship attack as Middle East turmoil worsens. The Houthis Armed Forces spokesman claimed rebel forces attacked the container ship CMA Taj after the vessel's captain ignored multiple warnings. The UK MTO organization reported a vessel that would have been in the same proximity of the Taj came under attack. An incident that has happened here in this region right here. Sometimes a picture is worth a thousand words. Container ships heading toward Europe and or North America, with almost all avoiding the Red Sea. Look at them. They are done with the Red Sea, and now we have a workaround around the tip of Africa. Yeah, it seems to be the only solution to... But yeah, so basically we have no more. We have no more commercial circulation in the Red Sea at this point. So the Houthis are effectively blocking a major maritime path. And Iran is being targeted by Israel, and Israel is showing aggressivity towards Syria, Lebanon, Gaza. It is a lot. It is a lot of provocation all at the same time. Can Israel even handle the pushback? Because it's easy when you're only doing the provocations and America is protecting you under certain circumstances, financially and intelligence-wise, and also at the mediatic level. I mean, it's a form of protection when the U.S. is basically covering here for Israel's involvement, which is most likely in the Iranian attack. It's a lot of support coming from the American side, but can they take back a true pushback against their strategy? If there were serious forces and serious bombardments toward Israel, it's also a small nation just like Gaza. They don't have much places to run. Civilian lives would be massively affected. Rudy Lucid says, it's funny how the Houthis are labeled as a rebel group in the mainstream media, yet they seem to be well-organized, informed, and financed for some small group of rebels. Oh yeah, you look at their military marches, and they looked relatively well-equipped. Not like a first-world power, but it's not a bunch of aggressive monkeys of the jungle, you know? They are an organized army. And if you're going to call them rebel, how is it that Zelensky isn't considered a rebel? You know, considering the history with Yanukovych and the whole putsch that has happened in Ukraine back in the days, what makes the Houthis a rebel group that doesn't make Zelensky a rebel group? Of course, it's the moral axis of the Zionist. It is what it is. But let's not deceive ourselves. Poopy Stinky Third Butt says, hey JF, happy new year. A drink, a tremendous amount of soda, roughly 12 by 12 FL ounce cans a day. For Christmas, I received a Keurig coffee machine and started drinking single cups of coffee. And I drink significantly less soda now. The greatest benefit of coffee over soda, you ask? You are never hungry. Yeah. You want me to subscribe to your fucking little cups of coffee? You've been enslaved by the system, my friend. You've been enslaved. I know what you're doing with your Keurig coffee machine in the morning, like the cuck that you are. You are opening your single-used coffee bunch and putting it in the single-used container of your Keurig machine. You are subscribed, motherfucker. They got you. Just like the Netflix subscription. You're paying a subscription to the system. Stop it, bro. Stop it. Wake up. Grind your own coffee. Do something. But don't buy these plastic single-use, single coffee containers. It's a shame. It's a fucking shame. Frederick von Finkel says, paying to be raped. Exactly. I'm disgusted. Canada called on all of its citizens to immediately leave Lebanon. When they call these Canadian citizens, it is what it is. You're going to have a lot of Lebanese in there. But in any case, there is a feeling of escalation in the region, like we've not seen for, I don't think we've seen, although we've seen bombarding of these same areas, I don't think we've seen as direct evidence that we are escalating toward an important conflict. Washington Post reporter doubles down. You didn't say that you condemn white supremacy, though. So, you know, the leftist, and I like the way Vivek describes this. They are asking him to recite their catechism. They are asking him, please denounce white supremacy, the same they did with Trump. But I like that Vivek is not biting it. And I like his response. Not that I found much hope on this guy, but it's a decent response. If we could have a Trump given that kind of response, that would be cool.
I'm not going to recite some catechism for you. I'm against vicious racial discrimination in this country. So I'm not pledging allegiance to your new religion of modern wokeism, which actually fits the test. I'm not going to bend the knee to your religion. I'm sorry. I'm not asking you to bend the knee to mine, and I'm not going to bend the knee to yours. But do I condemn vicious racial discrimination? Yes, I do. Am I going to play your silly game of gotcha? No, I'm not. And frankly, this is why people have lost trust. And I know you're going to go print the headline tomorrow. I already know this. We already know how your game works. Vivek Ramaswamy refuses to condemn white supremacy because you asked a stupid question. The reality is, I condemn vicious racial discrimination.
He sees her coming. They always want to repeat this recipe. It's like, oh, denounce white supremacy. And then they detect something in the sentence that seems to be a but or a conditional or a caveat. And, oh, he refused to full refused a full throated denunciation of white supremacy. And Vivek's angle on this is good. First, he understands that this is a game that she's playing. Second, he understands that this whole denunciation of white supremacy is like a zoom of the mediatic camera onto the least important racial force in America, which is, you know, white people being white supremacist and committing crime against minorities because of their white supremacy is a problem that's big like this in America. Black people committing murders of white people is a much bigger problem. And so we're not even talking about the discrimination as part of affirmative action, which precisely relies on this fake impression that somehow white racism is the big problem of America, when in fact it's the least. If you really want to care about racism in America, the least of your concern should be white people being racist.
Discrimination in this country, but the kind of vicious and systematic racial discrimination we see today is discrimination on the basis of race in a very different direction. You want to know what the best way is to end discrimination?
So here, he's like Trump a little bit. He refuses to say anti-white here. He says in the other direction. Remember, Trump had difficulty to say anti-white racism, and he said, it's racism that is inverted against the other direction. I mean, just say it, anti-white. Let's get done with it. It's not like you're going to be the president of the United States, right? So, and we both know what you're talking about, so use the words anti-white racism. And then you're going to trigger that journalist, and she's going to keep, anyway, she's going to smear you no matter what. So what do you have to lose but using the right words so that other people than me can understand what you're saying?
Discrimination on the basis of race. Stop discriminating on the basis of race. Do that, and we're going to move this country forward. And I don't care whether you're black or white or brown or anything in between. That's how we're going to unite this country. You people have been responsible for dividing this country to a breaking point, creating.
Well, now the media is there to divide people on the basis of race. The problem is once we have gotten rid of anti-white hate and the systemic punishment of white people on employment stuff or admission to universities, there will remain a division in this country. That's the problem. It's It's not by getting rid of affirmative action that you will eliminate division, racial division in this country. Racial division in this country will always exist. It will always exist because the races are too different. Too different to appreciate and to be fully capable of treating each other equally in all areas of life. It's not whether you want it or not. It's they can't. If I have a black neighbor, he cannot reciprocate the guarantee of security that it is to live alongside a white family. He cannot, because he's gonna have babies. These babies will be black. They will go toward the statistics of the average black person in America. And him being my neighbor is more costly for him, for me, than him, than me being his neighbor is costly for him. And that's a reality that will stay whether that we talk about it, whether the media is inflaming on the subject of race, whether the media is trying to gaslight white populations. Racial division is not a social construct. It's not something that we imposed ourselves and, oh my God, it would be fixed if we just couldn't say this or that or this, or if we could just shut down the biased media. This is where Vivek is wrong. Vivek is wrong because he has this naive MLK level view that, oh, if we could just get rid of the divisive discourse, we would all be together. No, Vivek, just look at the real estate markets. We're not headed toward a nation that lives together. It's not going to happen on its own, and you're not going to make it happen by censoring people.
Being a projection of national division, I meet people from the south side of Chicago to meetings like this one of every shade of melanin, multiple from man to woman, doesn't make a difference, who are hungry for reviving unity in this country. And you, with your catechism that you try to get as politicians to whatever fake headline you're going to print on the basis of this conversation tomorrow, that's what's dividing this country to a breaking point. Shame on you. Look people in the eye and tell them what you've actually failed to tell them for the last 5 years. Own the accountability for your own failures as the media. That's how we rebuild trust in this country. And until then, I don't have a lot of patience to play the games.
It's still a very good response, but it's a deluded response. But very good on the side of calling out this attempt by the journalist. Oh, this is heartbreaking. This guy has fallen in love with a trans woman who has educated him. And through education has convinced him that, yeah, he's not gay.
I was just very much confused.
I was confused too. Cassidy educated me and said, no, honey, you're straight. I'm like, don't you look at me like a woman? I said, yeah. She's like, so where do you find the word gay? And that's when I realized, yeah, I'm not gay at all.
Man, that is too bad. Look at his muscles. Look at his build. I mean, okay, he has the little tough guy attitude, but he could have gotten a reproductive girlfriend. Ah, but he got convinced that it's not gay. Oh, man. This is why it's so important to keep the words meaning what they mean. This is why the war that the trans community has led to be called woman because they feel woman. It's like, no, as far as he's concerned, you don't have the functionality of a woman. So by all criteria, he is fucking a guy. He is fucking a guy who cannot have his babies. That's all that matters. Whether you feel like a woman, whether you display like a woman, whether he's attracted to your woman displays, is all irrelevant. You could be in a bubble and be like, this is the allegory of the cave thought experiment. What if I was wearing a virtual mask all of my life that makes me experience a virtual reality? And every time I fuck a guy in the ass, somehow the pixels in my display They adjust reality for me and they make me believe that I'm really fucking a woman. Is that gay? Yes, it's gay. Because you're engaging in gay sex that will not lead to baby making. That's all that matters. That's all that makes it gay, by the way.
I was just very much confused.
I was confused too. Cassidy educated me and said, no, 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 honey, you're straight. Don't you look at me like a woman? I said, yeah. She's like, so where do you find the word gay? And that's when I realized, yeah, I'm not gay at all. I'm an alpha male that's attracted to femininity, and that's exactly what I got right here.
I'm an alpha male that's attracted to femininity. Unbelievable. The whole attraction to these side aspects of femininity, like the boobs and the looks, this was all meant to direct your dick toward a reproductive vagina. All of it becomes useless in the face of your stubborn refusal to admit to yourself you're gay. John Drake says, honey, haha, alpha. The words that he used to kind of dissociate from the gayest thing that he's doing. Real Base Talk says, alpha males get all the hot guys, lol. Yeah, I mean, he could have been an alpha. He could have been. These tough guys, they can get a cute girlfriend. Like, they can get a girl that would have blonde hair, that would have real boobs. He's muscled and everything. He didn't even need to have a good job. Just his muscle would have been perfectly enough to gather a white trash woman somewhere. But too bad, he has adopted a unreproductive lifestyle and his genes will disappear. Laura Loomer says that we should pay attention to the Supreme Court because the Supreme Court will be soon deciding they will be receiving an objection from Trump, maybe, or not, or from the Colorado GOP to review the whole removal of Trump from the ballots. That will be an important development. The parents of a 17-year-old woman who got, or girl, if you want to call her that way, the parents of a 17-year-old girl who got kidnapped and killed in 2009 are suing some hotel because she happens to have passed by that hotel during her spring break whoring spree. This is the summum of parental unwillingness to accept the consequences of their own and their daughter's bad decision. It was this girl, I don't know if you'll remember, Brittany Drexel from 2009. She ended up walking into the lobby of a hotel where one of her girlfriends was there. But she wasn't a customer at the hotel. She wasn't staying at the hotel. And eventually she goes walking alone on the beach, gets kidnapped and killed. And the parents are suing the hotel for not having a procedure to detect that they have minors in their lobby that are unaccompanied. It is your responsibility to make sure that your 17-year-old daughter doesn't end up in a spring break party. The hotel cannot have a way to verify all entering people just in case they wouldn't be 18 and they would be 17. You've let your daughter go to this party and a spring break party, and you've let her be away from home, have no means of protection, no boyfriend, no husband. And so she was out there partying and whoring. And she got what she deserved, which is you have exposed yourself to a risk of not being protected, of going where drunk and criminals will be. And it's not the responsibility of the hotel to pay for your lack of monitoring of your daughter. A grand jury has declined to file charges against a man who killed a robber I don't even know how to say it, at SW Houston Tech Area. We have the scene here. So a robber was coming with a gun. So drops something on the floor. He gets the cash from the customers. But see, this guy right here has a gun. And he kills the robber. Ah, robber is like Roger. The bird flu is giving me these easy to remember ways to retain how things are pronounced. Robber is like Roger. Okay, that's easy. Yeah, so I mean, I'm happy that this guy isn't getting sued, because that is totally fine. We should be able to defend ourselves against criminal, and this criminal had a gun. I mean, it was this criminal pointed his gun toward the guy who had a gun. So it's good that he didn't see him get the gun out. He probably assumed he was getting cash out of his shirt or whatever. Very good action there. And I'm happy that, unfortunately, we have more and more prosecution of these justiciers. And therefore, it's becoming more and more dangerous to defend yourself against criminals. Oh, people are complaining that, oh, there was a bullet at the end while he was on the floor. Listen, I am for giving a margin of generosity here. I mean, you don't know. This guy is moving. He's got a gun in his hand. You're a fraction of a second away from him being able, even if he got shot, him being able to turn around and shoot you. And so, shooting on the ground, I am totally fine with this. It's like, you cannot say that someone is fully neutralized because you've put one, two, or three bullets in them as they were standing. Who knows? Who knows whether they can still reach the gun, move, turn around? I mean, haven't you watched Inglourious Bastard? You know, the Nazi at the end is able to turn and shoot the girl. Pentagon's extremism in our ranks propaganda debunked by their own studies. Also, I guess this is... this is when General Mark Milley told Congress that he wanted to understand white rage. So you knew when he said this that he had gotten some coaching from some of these anti-racist coaches. Oh yeah, I'm open to understanding white rage. I want to understand what it is. Like, this doesn't come from nowhere. You got a little speech by these D'Angelo type of propagandists, for sure. and so there is a new policy that lays out banned activities which range from advocating terrorism or supporting the overthrow of the government to fundraising or rallying on behalf of an extremist group, or liking or reposting extremist views on social media. So new rules for the army. The problem is these rules will always be selectively imposed on certain beliefs. I am absolutely certain that you can still say stuff in support of Israel. You can still, in fact, advocate for the takeover of the American government by pro-Zionist, pro-Israeli forces. But if you were to suggest that the same be made by the Arab side, or that there be a Palestinian occupation of the American government, you would certainly be falling into the extremist statement category. So the problem with these is they are always extremely biased and biased toward the Zionist direction. We have Vivek here. See, Vivek, this is an example of Vivek being too high IQ for being a politician. He's able to play piano way too well. You cannot become a politician if you are capable of playing this. It's all good and it's all fun. Vivek is a guy we would want to have a barbecue with, but it's not going to get you to be a president. We need to return to an emphasis on meritocracy. I agree. But where do we begin? I mean, the leftists are attacking meritocracy on all possible sides. A M7.5 earthquake in Japan. We have some video of it. I didn't know that it was shaking the buildings in this way. It's fascinating. Look at this. Why do you put this bizarre music? Look at the buildings. They are shaking like in a cartoon. Here, the electricity cables are shaking. The metro signs. Wow, the whole structure of the metro with even the ceilings are shaking. Yeah, Nick says they're designed to move like this. Apparently, it could be partly a side effect of the fact that they are on pillars that are earthquake resistant, but that's precisely what the pillars do. They kind of absorb the oscillation of the earthquake into a flexible kind of rhythm. NYC Mayor Eric Adams warns that immigrants will soon be sleeping on the streets. What? They've not been sleeping on the streets since now. I mean, it's starting to be time. Yeah, at some point, if you have entered a country illegally, you don't have a job, there's a point at which you should be sleeping on the streets. Don't warn us about it. We do expect it to happen. Silver Spider says, "Hey, Jeff, you once said that UPB is a smokescreen and so universal preferential... universally preferable behavior is a smokescreen and all moral systems are based on consequentialism. How do we defend deontological morality? Does it just produce better consequences in the long run? If so, does the answer just come down to people who care more about the future versus instant gratification?" Well, I want to be clear here. I did make a case that ultimately all deontological beliefs can be framed within a lens of consequentialism. And in fact, a lot of the consequentialism beliefs can be framed into a lens of deontological. And Sam Harris has done some of this. The basic consequentialist belief is, oh, we have to make people feel good. We have to make people happy. Whatever results in more happiness is better. And then there's the counter from the deontologist that comes and says, well, we certainly don't act like this, and it would be hypocritical to say that we want to act like this, because the fact is you care more about the happiness of your child than you do about the happiness of a random person on the other side of the world. Which is the introduction of a deontological prior, that is, care more for your children because there's a reason to care more for them, because a system is well-ordered when evolutionary entities favor their own genes rather than the genes of some random people, which is exploitable. So all of this speaks to the deontological art. But a response from the consequentialist can be, well, I can frame what you just said as consequentialist. I can say, well, maybe it makes people more happy to care more about their... Maybe the fact that we care more about our children than random people is a recipe that results in more happiness. In other words, maybe if we weren't following these deontological rules, it would have conscious consequences. So I wanted to highlight that consequentialism and deontologicalism are not distinct entities that are truly fundamentally separate. They are ways to approach moral problems with priors, but they can be melded together through these kinds of response interaction, where you frame the other into your own terms. And the inverse of what I just did is also possible. Now, I want to be clear that this is not directly related to what you said in your first sentence. Universally preferable behavior being a smokescreen is a smokescreen for its own reason and not just that one. The objection that I take to universally preferable behavior is different. First, it is the false statement that it is objective. Universally preferable behavior, as written by Stefan Moliner, is appealing to subjective preferences. It is not an objective demonstration as it is claimed by Stefan. It is a language-based and logic-based derivation of morality, but the fact that these elements of logic are being accepted as the right one to stem morality from is, to begin with, an axiomatic presupposition that is subjective in nature. That is my opposition to UPB. It's not directly related to consequentialism, whether it exists as an independent category. Now you say, how do we defend deontological morality? Does it just produce better consequences in the long run? If so, does the answer just come down to people who care more about the future versus instant gratification? Very often, those will be the features that advantage a deontological thinker over a consequentialist one. But as I just said, these two categories are not truly sealed from each other. So I don't want to tell you that it's always the case, but generally in a debate, in an argument, the deontological argument will come out and will shine when you can make the case that the consequentialist is just not seeing all of the consequences. The consequentialist is always having an arbitrary blindfold as to where you will stop caring for the consequences. The consequentialist will tell you we have to go drill wells in Africa because people need water, and it's better to have people satisfied with their need for water rather than be thirsty. They feel better. Here's a consequence that's worth pursuing. The deontological advantage against a consequentialist argument will always be that there is something in the system that the consequentialist has intentionally or unintentionally omitted from his analysis. And here it's like, But if we keep drilling wells for people, they're going to have babies. These babies won't be able to drill their own wells, and we're going to have to go drill wells for their babies. So we're creating an infinite number. We're creating a parasitic system in which you are actually incentivized evolutionarily for blindly making babies without care for their sustainability, because white people will come and drill wells for you. And you are creating an infinite spam into the future of thirsty minds who one day or another will not get a white people to come drill their wells. And ultimately, you will have had a consequence of more suffering than the initial one you wanted to expunge. So generally, that is my approach for a deontological argument to undermine a consequentialist one. It is that there is always an arbitrary point at which you evaluate your consequences. Or else you are an infinite being. Like, are you able to compute the entire set of causes from your actions? Most people don't even look the next generation. Most people are like, oh, someone on the street, well, they need to be given a hotel. Well, what do you have here as a system? You end up with these dirty hotels filled with homeless people who have no care for it and who couldn't possibly care for their own property, let alone care for the property of others. And so you end up destroying your own system through parasitism. Generally, that is the scheme, and I have yet to see a single consequentialist belief or utilitarian belief that cannot be undermined by the scheme here. Now, I'm not going to say that all consequentialist beliefs necessarily have to, but I've not been presented with any case that cannot be addressed in that way. There's always something that the deontological analysis can capture in terms of self-annihilating mechanism that the consequentialist has forgotten. Ariel Suarez says, what are your main criticism of consequentialism? Well, I just did it, basically. But yeah, to summarize, consequentialism sets the unit of morality in a very impractical way that is inherently subjecting it to parasitism. So you're going to start caring for happiness, the happiness of conscious creatures. Conscious creatures are going to come and exploit it. Now you're going to say, oh, well, I will protect my consequentialism from this. I will put a caveat. So I will say, oh, well, you do care for the conscious creatures, but not for every conscious creatures equally. I will prefer some conscious creatures over others. So I will prefer my babies to the babies of others, for example. Well, now you have created a problem, which is you have created a kaleidoscope of various moral systems that are not contradictory. So you care for your babies, I care for my babies. But now we have a problem where some of my actions are leading to slightly more murderous babies and some of your actions are leading to slightly less murdering babies. And now my babies have a chance to be killed by your babies due to your actions. And now what? How do we resolve the living together in this context? What is fair for me to do to protect myself against your murdering babies that are just slightly more murdering than my murdering babies? And then we have the problem that there's an infinity of moral systems. Do I have the right to reject you? Well, in our society, we would say, well, that's discrimination. You cannot reject my murdering babies because of their skin color. Well, okay, but I know that they have more chance than being murdering babies. Don't I have self-defense? Well, you have self-defense, but you have to wait that they take the gun and point it toward you. Well, okay, so I have self-defense, but you neutralize it to the extent that I can't even defend myself in advance. So I don't have all possible self-defense strategies. You've just neutralized one of them. And now we enter necessarily the deontological world, which is, what is it that's fair for me to do given the risks that you constitute for my life? And what is it that's fair for all of us to do against each other? Necessarily entering, therefore, not the world of consequentialism, but the world of deontology. And that is the problem of consequentialism, is that the worlds built from consequentialism necessarily leave unaddressed problems that must be addressed through a deontological lens. Here, I'm going to give you another example. We care about the minds of conscious creatures. They need to be happy. Okay. Sam Harris, moral landscape type of society. Okay, well, here's a baby that will become a heroin addict, or he will become a guy on the street. He has that much chance of becoming a guy on the street or an addict of some sort. Should we let it live? Should we give him an abortion? Well, let's give him an abortion. If he's gonna be above this poverty threshold, let's give him no abortion. And if he's below this poverty threshold, let's give him an abortion. Human life isn't worth living below this threshold. Well, here's a mother that comes, and that's her strategy. She wants to reproduce with these trashy white guys who leave her in poverty, but that's the only way she can have babies. That's her existential prayer. She wants to put people into the world, and she's not offended by the degree of their suffering. You are. So you have a Sam Harris omniscient moral landscape decider saying, okay, that's the level of poverty at which human life isn't worth living. But then you have the existential prior that comes and says, hey, I have the right to exist. My babies have the right to exist. And yes, they're going to live in white trailer trash type of environments, but that's how we live. That's our way of living. And now you've entered already the deontological world. How is it that a society will decide to tell poor people you shouldn't be living? You don't have a right to live because your suffering is offensive to us. Because let me tell you this. There's a bunch of white babies that are being killed in the womb right now through abortion. Their life would be orders of magnitude, arguably, better than a lot of non-white babies who are let to live. In other words, the threshold for your offense against suffering is inherently in conflict against existence. And in fact, this is one thing I had written to Sam Harris. You want to have a threshold of poverty below which human life isn't worth living. You define human life as worth living only above a certain level of happiness. But you don't specify the number of minds that should live. And who are we going to be to decide to say, well, there should be 10 billion people on planet Earth, or there should be 1,000 billion people, or there should be 500 million people on planet Earth? Who decides the function linking the value of a human mind with respect to its suffering? And who are we to shut down a woman who says, I want there to be one more human mind existing in society? Who is going to be the abortionist doctor who goes to see that woman and say, no, you can't, because we've made the calculation, the existence of your baby will reduce the amount of happiness of all the others. And so you can't have your baby. You are entering the domain of genocide. You are entering the domain where deontological considerations are needed. Those are my critique of consequentialism and the deontological response to it, which I think is this one. Consequentialism always leaves door open and unaddressed questions that create infinite number of conflicts of different moral views and moral worlds, which must be solved by deontology. That is it for tonight, boys. Thank you for being here. Much love, and I'll see you all tomorrow. Thank you.